listening to the Rewild Yourself podcast. Awaken your instincts.
Welcome back to the Rewild Yourself podcast. I'm your host, Daniel Vitalis. This show is brought to you by SirThrival.com. Head over to the SirThrival store. Check out our selection of pine pollen products. Pine pollen delivers androgens like testosterone directly to your body, particularly in its tincture format. And we've got an awesome selection there. It is pine pollen season, or just about to be here in the Northeast where I live. This is the time of year where lots of us, if we live in a place with pine forests, begin ingesting pine pollen inadvertently, just by the sheer kind of quantity of pollen that's in the air. And we start to absorb some of that. So do the soils. So do the plants. This stuff is filled with plant steroids, that kick off spring growth. And like I said, the androgens, they really get us revved up again metabolically and hormonally as well. So you want that stuff in your body. This is the time. Use the coupon code REWILD. It'll get you 10% off your order. Also, if you have received your I'd Rather Hunt and Gather t-shirt, do post pictures of yourself in it. We'd love to see that. Use the hashtag RatherHuntGather and tag myself at Daniel Vitalis and Sir Thrival at Sir Thrival. Thanks so much, and we will repost pics that we love. Hey, this show is also brought to you by Living Libations. If you're looking for skincare, hair care, and dental care products so good you can eat them because they do not contain the excipients, preservatives, and other nasties that make it into all the cosmetic goods in our country, then you want to check out livinglibations.com. Use the coupon code REWILD for 5% off your order. I love the stuff Nadine Artemis makes and use, well, quite a bit of it right here in my own bathroom. So some updates for you. Wow, do I have poison ivy right now? It's hard. It's a hard life. The foraging struggles are real. This is the time of year when the leaves have not emerged yet. They're just starting to emerge on poison ivy, but poison ivy is like a woody shrub. So it's got this like woody stem that sticks up in the ground, and it's just kind of, unless you're really paying attention, it's easy to not notice. I've managed to get it twice now already this season. And, recently went out for some nettle foraging, and, you know, nettle foraging can also be a little bit brutal depending on how much nettle you gather. And I gather quite a lot of it. So my fingers and my legs, I had shorts on. I just was stung so much, and all over places where I already had poison ivy. And I'm also my skin is so sensitive right now because we're in the midst of our deer tick season. And during that time, I become incredibly sensitized to the sensation of anything that might be crawling on me so that I can find those ticks and get them off. Obviously, living with the threat of Lyme disease and other co-infections here in Maine, it's a serious thing, and I take it, I scrutinize myself at least twice a day looking for ticks. So, wow, was I uncomfortable the other night. I laid in bed all night, could not sleep, just felt like I was on fire, right? It's like the poison ivy is itching, the nettle stings are burning, and I'm just feeling like the creepy crawly all over myself. I love this time of year. So good. Yeah, I ended up finding a tick actually embedded in me, one morning this week. I'll say in a tender body part that typically only males of our species carry. And I found it underneath there, kind of dug himself in. And man, brutal. It was a deer tick, or the black-legged tick, the tick that does, can be a vector for the Lyme infection. So I take that kind of tick real seriously, as opposed to what we call our wood tick or our dog tick, which, very rarely is going to carry something like that, or very rarely contributes to any kind of spread of infection. But this black-legged tick is a pretty serious thing. So they have long mouth parts. It's one of the things that distinguishes them from the dog tick. And he had gotten one real deep in me and the other one partially into me, and was able to remove him, but some of those mouth parts stayed in, not the whole head or anything, but those mouth parts. and had to really dig around with tweezers. Kind of awful experience because you're asking yourself, like, how long was it there? Is this serious? Might I have contracted Lyme? Should I send this tick into a lab? Do I need to take antibiotics? Do I need to get on an herbal course? Like, all these questions run through your mind. And in the end, I brought up recently on one of the episodes a couple weeks ago where we talked about Lyme disease and how I deal with ticks. And I told you that my primary method is twice a day religiously before bed and again in the morning, because these ticks need to be on you for 12 to 24 hours in order to transmit these infections. And I take a lot of comfort in finding a tick embedded in me and knowing that I checked myself the night before and that it hasn't been there for any length of time beyond my sleep cycle. In other words, I know that that tick wasn't there the night before and that it got on me sometime in the night and embedded itself then. So I know it hasn't been there long enough for me to have the concern that I might have contracted Lyme from it. So I say that to reinforce this idea of, if you live in an area where ticks are a problem, and that's a lot of us now, unfortunately, double duty twice a day, checking yourself before bed and when you get up. And a lot of times I check myself throughout the day as well, just staying on top of it, because there are so many here during this little period of time in the spring and then again in the fall. It'll get to be summertime and it'll be too hot for them, and I look forward to that because it's a lot to stay on top of this. But anyway, my skin is finally relaxing now. The poison ivy is still there. The nettles have long since worn off. And you know what? It's like, once we start eating those nettles, man, it's worth it. It's so worth it. Another exciting kind of foraging update is I was out canoeing recently with Avani, and we came across groundnut, or sometimes called hopness. I like that name, hopness, so the same there. And he talks about it in his book. Now, I wasn't sure what I had come across. We found a tuber, sort of a couple of them, sticking out of a riverbank along a kind of a flood zone, already kind of washed by the current, and sort of hanging out of what was like an eroded river bank where you could tell they were previously under the soil. So I pulled them away, and being me, I decided to bite into it, and the flavor was real good. Sweet and starchy. These were about the size of a golf ball. Sent pics off to a friend to see if he knew what they were. He directed me to Apios Americana, hopness, or the groundnut. I went to Sam Thayer's books, The Forager's Harvest and Nature's Garden. And by the way, those are two books that you want in your library if you have any interest in foraging wild plants. These are fantastic books. Whether you live in a place where these plants grow or not, the way these books are done very differently than most foraging books. Each plant gets a chapter unto itself with deep explanation about how he harvests and processes. And this is important knowledge, whether you use specifically these plants or you're just adapting some of this information. We'll put links to those books in the show notes, and know that we are tentatively booking another interview with Sam, so hopefully he'll be back on the show. Anyway, I'm really pumped about this plant because groundnut's a bit like, hopness is a bit like a potato, starchy, a little sweeter, and it fills a really interesting niche in the diet. We have wild rice growing wild here, and we have acorn, but nothing in my diet that's like that starchy potato-like thing. I would really like to fill that gap. I'm constantly looking for how I can reduce the amount of produce I need to buy. Obviously, I still buy a lot. I don't live on a completely wild diet, but that is like my long-term dream vision. You know, is it possible? And is it possible in a modern context? So I think this plant's going to be filling a really important role, you know, here in my household. So pretty excited about that. I'm also getting ready to head off to Florida in just a couple days, and I will be, well, actually by the time you're hearing this, I'm recording in the future, in the past for the future. I'll be gone when you hear this. I'll be in Florida. And the weather's not looking great. I was really hoping to go mahi-mahi fishing, but looks like we'll get into at least some snapper fishing, and I'll be harvesting iguanas, I think, as well. Again, so be down in the Keys by the time you hear this. I'm really looking forward to that, and getting to spend some time with a new friend I made down there, Jim, who is a guy who likes to hunt and gather in all types of diverse ways. And so looking forward to bringing a whole bunch of goodies from Maine down there. I'll be bringing him some acorn flour. I'll be bringing down, leeks preserved in oil. I'll be bringing fresh leeks, all kinds of stuff. I mentioned last week that I like to travel with a cooler. And so I'll be bringing all kinds of things from here, birch sap, maple syrup, all kinds of things. And just really excited to share that with him. And, he always has gator meat at his place. So real excited about that as well. Hey, I want to remind you to subscribe to my newsletter that comes out every 2 weeks, new moon and full moon. Lots of podcast extras, photos that don't make it onto my social media, stories told about trips that I take, gear that I use, etc. Would love to have you on that list. And I steward that list with a lot of care. So don't worry that you're going to start getting other email. We're start inundating you with stuff. We're real respectful and like to send those newsletters out as kind of a reminder of when we are in the season. Hey, you can also send your questions over to me at info@danielvitalis.com. And I'm going to read a couple of questions that came in this week that I think are very related to the conversation that we just had in the one that's going to be in this interview today with none other than Lierre Keith. First question's from Jeff, and he says, I've been focused on foraging and now hunting, practicing my turkey calls this morning, but something I've been thinking about lately is if, when, and how much small-scale horticulture is compatible with rewilding. Put another way, we know historically the negative consequences that began to emerge as humans created permanent settlements and converted land over to human agricultural use, like hierarchy, patriarchy, land-based destruction, overpopulation, war, etc. So where do we draw the line? How much gardening and permaculture and animal husbandry is sustainable, if at all? In addition, I'd love to hear you talk about this in regard to pre-Columbus indigenous Americans, and what point did they become agriculturalists burdened with all the trappings of civilization? I've been assuming that migratory tribes or seasonal nomadism would be ideal. Is this correct? Is this something we should strive for? I've been trying to sort this out. Another question came in from Charisse Cassini. She says, hi, Daniel. You talk a lot about foraging wild foods, something I've started doing but haven't found the time to fully commit to. But what are your thoughts on organic and non-GMO gardening? I've been doing it for going on 6 years now. Is this something you do, or do you shop at farmers markets? I'm trying to find a balance of being a mother and a wife and going to school and working a full-time job and maintaining a garden, actually being able to forage wild foods rather than dabble in it. My goal is to raise my children in a way that they don't feel the constraint that time puts on us and to be able to show them that it is possible to do all these things while living in a modern society where we have to earn money. Wow. Okay. These questions felt really related to me, and I wanted to take them on together. First thing I want to say is, like, let's have this conversation with, like, no pressure at all, because we're having this conversation over modern, you know, technological devices, whose origins are far less savory than anything we have to worry gardening is going to create. Right. So, it's funny, because food does this strange thing to us. We start thinking in ideals a lot of times with food. And I know I'm certainly guilty of that all the time. And this thing of wild food so consumes me at times that I almost forget to give shouts out to the people who do small scale agriculture in a way that isn't super destructive to ecology and supports their needs and the needs of a lot of other people, including myself. I do buy things at the farmer's market. All right. Next is, I'm hardly, you know, like an authority on all this. I'll share what I know about how people lived prior to the agricultural revolution and after it. You know, of course, 10,000 years ago is that sort of generic date that we give for when agriculture began. But for most of the world, it didn't begin then. For a lot of the world, it didn't begin until, in some cases, very recently, and in some cases hasn't even begun yet. So it's something that's still playing out. We're sort of in the end stages of the Neolithic Revolution, as it's called. As far as, like, where to draw the line, you know, like, this is an interesting, it's an interesting thing, because there are people who lived as pure hunter-gatherers, and there are people who live and lived as, and still live today as hunter-gatherers. And there are people who have lived as pure agriculturalists. Most of us were raised that way. But there are a lot of people who lived an in-between path of sort of the hunter-gatherer-gardener, if you will. And that was especially true here in North and South America on these continents. We find that pre-Columbus, there was a tremendous amount of agriculture going on. So keep in mind that the Peruvians and people along the Andes had developed agriculture. They were growing potatoes and tomatoes and quinoa and things like that. many foods that we now think of as being associated with other cultures. I mean, it's fascinating that we'll kind of consider the tomato to be an Italian food, even though it was developed in the so-called New World, developed in Peru. The potato we might think of as being a kind of Irish food, when in reality it's, again, a food of the Andes. Maize, perhaps we think of as a sort of North American food, corn, but was developed in Mexico by the Aztecs, who were practicing agriculture. And then the Mississippian culture, which was up into Middle Americas, Middle North America. They also practicing all kinds of agriculture, including growing maize, that had made its way up from Mesoamerica. So in addition to that, though, I mean, lots of other crops, right? Including tobacco, which was grown and traded all over the Americas. So there was a lot of gardening going on. It wasn't like a pure, you know, hunter-gatherer kind of utopia or anything like that. So I think that needs to be pointed out. The other thing is, like, where do we draw the line between what's agriculture and what's sort of tending a wild landscape? Because I think, in fairness, those, even those parts of North America where civilization hadn't begun, because there were several civilizations here when the people of these continents met with the civilizations of Europe. There was a lot of people who were doing what we call like tending the wild. And by the way, that's a fantastic book, Tending the Wild. Highly recommend that. It looks at how native peoples of, California worked with you could almost, it's like you're tempted to use the word gardening. They almost gardened the wild landscape, encouraged it into more productivity. And I think that ultimately that's like, I kind of think of us a bit like beavers, animals that have these profound impacts on the landscape, but in a way that creates more habitat and diversity. I think that's what we do. That's like our eco niche, is that when we hunt and gather, we encourage habitat and we make changes to the landscape. Make no kind of mistake about that. We do, but in a way that creates more abundance and more diversity. I think that's a really beautiful thing. People were doing that all over North and South America. People do that wherever they're found. Now we also see that people who hunt and gather often have some crops, not always, but some. Where do we draw that line? Is burning a field down to encourage changes to the landscape kind of horticulture? Is if I pull leek bulbs up from the ground, but I put the seed head back in the ground, am I planting those seeds? Yeah. Is that agriculture? I don't know. So there's kind of it's not black and white. That, I think that's a really important kind of thing to keep in our minds. Second thing I want to say is I don't garden. And maybe it's my own folly. I like to support the farmer's market. So I do buy produce there when I can't forage it. Like right now is a time of year where I have so much wild greens around me. I'm not buying anything at the farmer's market. I just don't need to. But in a couple of months, it's going to get a lot hotter here. Everything's going to kind of go to medicine. There's going to be a lot of fruits, but if I want green plants or vegetables, I'm probably going to be buying them at the farmer's market. Now, I don't practice gardening, at least at this time in my life, and have tried a couple times throughout my life, but just so half-heartedly. I don't, and I'm going to explain why, but it's not like a moral, ethical thing. It has to do with my time management. So I personally would rather spend my time out on adventures getting wild foods than I want to spend that time kind of wrestling with nature to grow a garden. And those of you who garden or farm, even if you don't like it, and probably the permaculturalists are going to get the most annoyed by what I'm saying here. But I think that if we get real honest, we can see it's true. If you want to raise domesticated plants and animals, you are going to fight nature all the time. You're going to fight to get that soil the way you're going to want it. You're going to fight to keep the critters off it, the insects that want to eat those domesticated plants, the predators and scavengers that want to steal off your chickens or your eggs or whatever it is. There's a lot of fight there. You know, keeping things watered when things get dry. It's a lot of work weeding things up because you've created this kind of soil that's so easy for things to grow in. what's interesting is that a lot of times what you see people doing is weeding out plants that would grow by themselves and have more nutrition than the plants they're actually trying to grow, which have less nutrition and are way more finicky and need all this like support and to grow. I mean, it's ironic to see the efforts that we go through. Also, well, this is a little off topic, but you know, you look at, I guess, bigger picture of that is like thinking about what happened when Europeans came to North America and they wanted to eradicate the bison and bring cows, right? They wanted to, eradicate the forests and then bring in all of these plants and trees from Europe, right? They wanted to change what was actually growing here of its own will and kind of had been tended by people and was massively productive in order to bring non-native things here and fight against nature in order to make it like where they were from. It's a very strange mentality, and you kind of see it microscopically in the garden at home. In order to grow things from other places, very few people are gardening things from the place where they live. So if you have a garden, it's likely that most of what you are growing comes from anywhere but where you are. And then you put a tremendous amount of work in. I would rather, instead of watering, instead of weeding, instead of lugging soil and sprouting things inside, all that stuff, I would rather be outside on my canoe, walking through the woods, hunting and gathering. It just makes more sense to me. And the food is higher quality. It's higher in nutrition, not just vitamins, minerals, protein, things like that, but we're also talking about all of the phytochemistry that's in our wild plants. We're talking about better ratios of omega-3s to 6s in our animal foods. So I do think it makes more sense from a nutritional perspective. But that said, I rely still on garden food, and I really appreciate the people who do that work, because I don't want to do that work. I'd rather be out playing in the sort of Garden of Eden that is left on this planet. So I'd rather give money to those folks who want to do that work and who like doing that work, rather than me doing it. And I'm happy to put my money into that economy and my local economy to support local farmers. And I have to buy some stuff at market too. And so, you know, that means I'm putting money into California's organic, you know, gardening world or farming world. Not my favorite thing to do, but something that I do. So I want to be real clear about that. As far as what role does gardening play in rewilding? Well, I just think anything you're doing to get close to your food source is really, really good. I don't think it's the ultimate answer, because I think that what, like, we can see in the human fossil record the negative impacts that farming had on our bodies. Like, it literally left scars on our bodies within a couple generations. We see that in our fossil record. It's incredible. It's not good for us, but it's a lot better for us than living away from the soil and further away from our food source. So it's better than what most Americans are doing right now. But is it as good for us as spending time out in nature while foraging and hunting? I don't think so, but that's my opinion. I do think some small-scale gardening makes a lot of sense for most people who are willing to do it, particularly if you want to have certain medicine plants that you might need or want, things that you're not going to harvest wild, things that aren't out there, things that are useful to you that you use a lot of, that you buy a lot of. I think it makes a lot of sense. So, you know, for me, it's just what I'm really interested in is, again, what's this middle ground? Like, what if I establish nettles here where I live? It's a wild plant that I can find out on my landscape. But if I establish it here, I won't have to travel as far to get it, but I also don't have to water it. I also don't have to take care of it, right? What if we practice a kind of permaculture and landscape design that works with wild and native plants? Rather than growing an apple orchard, can I grow a shad bush orchard, for instance, a local plant that is native to where I live and produces wonderful fruits? Is that viable? And I'm sure there's lots of people working on that. In fact, if you know people that do that, let me know about that, because I'd love to talk to some of those folks. So anyway, I just think that, let me add one more piece. I often hunt and gather on farms that belong to friends of mine, because farming creates lots of diversity in the landscape. Big picture, it does not. Big picture, it creates monoculture, and we know that when we're talking about the farm industry. But the local small organic farms that I know about and that I visit, they tend to have a lot of edge line, which deer and turkeys like. They tend to have a lot of weed plants, which are, that's funny, weed plants, plants that we consider weeds that are medicinal. They tend to have a lot of the older oaks because they haven't been logged, and so they'll have great acorns. So I like visiting my friends' farms to forage. And it's so funny because I enjoy the foraging piece so much, and I look over and I see the work they're doing, and I come out for a couple hours and I get enough food for, you know, weeks, and I see them out there all day just to get sort of enough going to get to farmer's market. It's like, man, it's a lot of work. So anyway, I do take advantage of the fact that there are people doing that kind of gardening and farming. So it's not really a morality issue. It's about a time management thing. And I just prefer to spend my time in habitat, working with nature alongside it like another animal, versus kind of fighting it like a being from another planet who's trying to change the landscape to produce what I want versus what it wants. I think that's the, okay, there is a bit of a moral thing there, I guess, at the end, for me. But at the same time, I get that driving my car isn't what nature wants, and I get that having a mobile phone isn't what nature wants. So ultimately, it's really about, like, how do you want to spend your days? I certainly know a lot of people who have farmed and are farming and garden a lot who are slowly giving it up because they realize that they get more productivity and more enjoyment out of going after wild food and more adventure going after wild food than working so hard to grow stuff. That said, I'd hate to see certain things go away. I like having tomatoes. I do. A few other things as well come to mind. So, I think it's, you know, it's a balancing act. But to answer your question, like, where does it fit in rewilding? It's wherever you want to fit it. I'm so not dogmatic, really. It's just like, we just need to do whatever works. We need to preserve our health. We need to, make sure as a species we stay viable, because we have created a situation on our planet where it's very inhospitable to our species and many other species at this point, hence the great extinction that we're undergoing. Whatever we got to do to stay healthy, stay viable, stay fit for our environment, I think we need to do. But long term, when we look out with the longest lens possible, is this fight with nature that we do called agriculture really sustainable in the long run? I don't think so. I think it'll eventually go away. If humans are able to continue living on, you know, on Earth long term, I do think it's something that will eventually go away. Every civilization that's practiced it in the past collapsed. And we're going to talk more about that in this interview. Look at that segue. Completely accidental. This show today is with Liere Keith. Her book had a tremendous impact on my life at a time when, if you know my backstory, I'd been a vegan for a long time, a vegetarian even longer. It consumed a tremendous amount of my life. I look back with a lot of regrets on that because it did damage to my health, and because it was not just what it did to my physical body, but kind of emotionally as well. That was a crazy ride. I'm also grateful. I learned a tremendous amount. Now, at the time, about living and about food and about where things come from, et cetera, et cetera. So in a way, glad I did it, but wish I had listened to my body a lot earlier. And that's why I'm always telling people to listen to their bodies and use their sovereignty and not to get kind of swept up in the kind of madness of groupthink, which I definitely did at certain points. And that said, when I decided to start eating animal foods again, wow, I went through some serious moral struggles. And I know a lot of people listening have had a similar journey. You may have had a similar journey. And when you're first kind of coming to grips with all of it again, because you've had this moral stance about something and you feel like now you're participating in a thing that you saw as really ugly, and now you're kind of confused. There's like cognitive dissonance. And I was walking into a bookstore in San Francisco, I came across this book called The Vegetarian Myth. And I'd just, you know, been eating meat for a little while. I had been reading a lot of books on the kind of ancestral perspective of nutrition. And this book had kind of one of the French cave paintings on it, as I recall. It said The Vegetarian Myth by Liere Keith. I picked it up, looked it over, never put it back down till it was done. I read it cover to cover, and it was so healing for me. Because it helped me to see that all of the outcomes that I had hoped to achieve through veganism were actually achieved through a balanced omnivorous diet, and that what I thought I was doing before was actually, I was mistaken. That I thought eating a vegan diet was better for the environment. Turns out it's not. I thought it was better for our health. Turns out it's not. I thought it was more evolutionarily appropriate. Turns out it's not, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this book really helped me. Lierre's journey was a similar one, long term, longer than me, vegan, and also did a lot of damage to her health, but has since gone on to help a tremendous amount of people. She's also very interested in kind of the long-term impacts of the way we live and our civilization on ecology and on the earth as well. So I think this is a real eye-opening conversation. I want to apologize for the audio quality. It's not super good through a lot of the interview, just due to the fact that we had to meet on Skype. So, I apologize for that, but I think the content speaks for itself. So enjoy this interview with Lierre Keith. I'll be fishing in Florida, but I'll be back next week, next Wednesday with another show for you. Until then, enjoy this one. Let me know what you think and keep rewilding.
Lierre Keith is a writer, radical feminist, food activist, and environmentalist. Her book, The Vegetarian Myth, Food, Justice, and Sustainability, has been called the most important ecological book of this generation. Her writing and lectures focus on civilization's violence against the planet, male violence against women, and the need for serious resistance to both. Lierre, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Hey, I'm thinking what I'm about to say, I went back and forth if I was going to say this or not, but I'm thinking you hear this a lot, but your book came my way kind of right at the right time in my life, and I had, like you and like so many people in our generation, been a vegan for a long time. I had kind of just started coming out of that, got my hands on Weston Price's book, and sort of found my way out, but I really, really needed to hear the argument laid out the way you laid it out, and it really helped me to get through the guilt portion transitioning to a more sustainable lifestyle. I'm sure you hear that kind of thing a lot.
I do. And of course, it is the main reason that I wrote the book that I wrote, because I needed that when I was sort of crawling out of veganism. I was very confused for, you know, a good 5 years. I did not understand what had happened or why. And this was the information that I needed. And eventually it just made sense to put it in a book.
Could you give us kind of a haiku version? I think a lot of the listeners here have read your book and are familiar with your work, but for those who aren't, what's the kind of haiku version of how you came to write this book and, you know, what it was about, what it meant for you over the, you know, that period of time where you wrote it and after it came out?
So I was a vegan for 20 years and I did permanent damage to my body, some of it quite catastrophic. So, you know, I think a lot of us hit that point. Maybe not quite as far along as I got, but you start to realize that this is just simply not working. And everything that you thought you knew about the world, about even the cosmos, kind of collapses on you. See, the thing about being a vegan is that it's not just what you eat. It really becomes who you are. You know, it's your identity. And when that fails, it you don't know who you are. You know, it's like this huge crisis of what is my place on the planet? What is my place with other humans? And
what makes
ultimately,
me special?
Yeah, what makes me special? And all these things that I believed, what if none of them were true? So for me, I could at least come back to sort of my basic ethical framework, which still held. You know, I still did care about sustainability and justice and cruelty and all the things that had always motivated me. But I realized that the kind of ideology I had built on top of that kind of ethical framework wasn't going to work, and that there was alternate information that I had been resisting really for as long as I'd been a vegan. Because I am not someone who ever stopped being intellectually curious or stopped my own experiments with trying to be sustainable. And I kept hitting that wall of, you know, realizing that veganism actually was not going to be a way forward for the planet. But I believed in it so strongly that I didn't know how to engage with that new information. So that was a 20-year back and forth for me. And there's a lot of other people who have been through this. You know, you start gardening and you realize that the soil needs to eat. And what does it want to eat? Well, it wants to eat dead plants and dead animals. And if you're only giving it part of that equation, you're not giving it everything. So I could see pretty quickly that my garden was going to give out, you know, in my lifetime. So what then? And so you have to face this sort of, you know, there's these cycles on the planet that we do not control and that don't care what our framework is. That they, you know, this has been happening for, you know, life has been on this planet for billions of years, and it has its own way. And it's not the way that was the vegan way. It eats. And it eats everything, and it does it in a very beautiful set of very complicated relationships, which you know, to our detriment, we ignore. So all of that kind of falls in on you, you know, as you're trying to, you know, what am I going to eat now? Where do I go from here? And so I, you know, in the end, I did figure out, I think, a much better framework that takes into account a much broader scale and scope of both the destruction that's happening to the planet and really our best way out. And it was so hard won for me and so such an emotionally grueling process that I ended up thinking, you know, I know I'm not the only one. And certainly meeting people who were still in that level of just, you know, despair and confusion because the vegan diet was failing them and they couldn't get themselves out. You know, and I have these long conversations, you know, for hours with some of them. And, you know, eventually they would feel better, but you get to that point of, I can't keep having the same conversation over and over with every recovering vegan. I'm going to have to just write this down and let other people find it. You know, it's, you can reach a lot more people that way. So that was ultimately why I wrote the book, was because I needed that book, you know, and I didn't have it. So
I really appreciate what you've talked about, this piece of the damage it can do to your body. And the reason is I come out of the raw food. I was sort of at ground zero of the raw food vegan world in its modern incarnation, and that its own breed of culty insanity.
Sure.
And in that side of the house, as I'm sure you're aware, it's a bit different than the, I guess, the pastry kind of bakery style veganism. I kind of see those two styles.
Right.
And on that side of the house, you have this, you can cure anything by just fasting. You can cure anything with juice. And the idea of damage to your body seems unthinkable. All you got to do is eat more grapes or more apples or more bananas or whatever. And I definitely did some serious harm to myself. And that's something I've heard you talk about. And I don't hear as many people talking about that part. So without, you know, having to rehash it too much, just can you kind of give us a little bit of a summary of what kind of damage you might have done or somebody can do to their body? Because I think a lot of people don't realize that dietary experiments, and certainly veganism is one of the more popular ones today, carries very significant consequences, or can.
Yeah, well, the first thing you're going to do is blow through your insulin receptors, because the human body was never meant to handle that load of sugar every single day. And if it makes you feel better to call it complex carbohydrate, you're welcome to do that. But it does get broken down into simple sugars in order to be digested. So it doesn't actually matter whether you're eating brown rice or white rice. It's the same load of sugar. So there's that problem. And that's an incredible excess that we just did not evolve to handle. And so it creates an emergency situation in your body every single time you do it. So there's this flood of insulin, and then, you know, the insulin, you know, circulates throughout your blood and it grabs onto pretty much everything it can find and it shoves it into your fat cells as fast as it can, just so you don't die. You know, your brain can only function at a very narrow range of sugar. If it's too high or too low, you can fall into a coma, you can do permanent damage, and you can die. So you're triggering that response, and it's an emergency response that also involves a lot of adrenaline over and over and over. And if you're doing that 3, 4, 5 times a day over the course of even a few years, your insulin receptors, which are on, you know, the cells in your body, it's how insulin locks into those cells and either get, you know, can get the sugars in or out. They just wear down. It's like a lock and a key. You know, if you use it too many times, it just gets worn. And this, of course, is what leads to diabetes. So you need more and more insulin so it can have any effect at all. And eventually your pancreas just gives out and can't keep making that load of insulin. But there's a whole cascade of effects that happen from having that level of insulin in your bloodstream all the time. And then those kind of roller coasters of the up and down, too much blood sugar, too low blood sugar, then you have to eat some more to get it back up. And it's miserable when you're going through it. And you don't realize, of course, I certainly didn't, because it doesn't happen overnight. You know, if you ate one meal and you felt like that, you'd stop. But for most of us, it takes time.
The initial transition of veganism feels, as I recall, quite good, actually. It takes a while before you start to feel bad.
It can for many people. You know, you can 3 months, 6 months, a year, 2 years even, you're feeling pretty good. And then it slowly creeps up on you that you're not feeling so good. And the problem is, if you're really ideologically, you know, fundamentalist about it, which many of us were, you just buckle down and say, well, I just need to be stricter. I just need to eat, you know, even fewer of this and even more of that. And you drive yourself further and further into that world rather than out of it. I will say, though, that, you know, the studies that have been done show that most people do not stay vegan more than 3 months. So most people who try it give it up pretty quickly because they're a little smarter than me and they realize that they feel like crap.
I used to do, when I would give big talks, I would do, if I had a significant audience, I had this little experiment. I would say, put your hand up if you know a vegan. And I would watch all the hands go up and I'd say, leave them up. And only, you know, only leave them up if you know somebody who's been a vegan more than 5 years. And you'd lose most of the hands.
Yeah.
And then I'd go 10 years. And by the time you get to 20 or 30, there's very few hands, if any, left. 20 years, you said you did. That's how I did 10, and that's longer than most. 20 is a long time, Lier. A long time. Wow.
Well, and I mean, I stand here as, you know, a kind of scary, you know, example of what can go wrong. It's, and you're, people are more than welcome to use my life as, you know, as an example of, you know, how bad it can get. I ended up with degenerative discs in my spine, so I can only stand up about 30 minutes at a time because the pain is so extreme. And that's never going to go away. You know, you degrade your joints to that point and there's no getting them back.
And this is caused by which aspect of the of dietary deficiency?
Well, I would say it's a bunch of things combined, but all of them spell vegan. So, right. One of the main problems is simply not having enough fat in the diet, especially enough saturated fat. A lot of people don't know this, but in order to absorb any minerals in your digestive tract, you actually have to have fat present to do that. So if you're eating these, you know, kind of insane low fat diets, you can't get enough minerals. So that's problem number one. And that's, of course, you know, a huge part of what your joints are made out of. You have to have enough minerals. Problem number two is that even if you were getting enough fat, these diets are so low in minerals that, they're just aren't going to be enough for, you know, proper repair of joints. So that's another big problem. And then you have the fat soluble vitamins like vitamin A and vitamin D, which can only be found in animal fat. And they are absolutely crucial to proper joint repair. And you're just not going to get those eating plants because plants don't need them. They don't make them. And like vitamin D is basically the matrix for your bone and also plays a very similar role in joint health. So, I mean, all of that is missing. And so you can even talk about specific minerals like zinc, which is it's very, very hard to get through plant sources. And then another problem on top of that, of course, is soy, which, I mean, we could just talk for a few hours about soy, but one of the things that soy is especially good at blocking is zinc uptake. And so I'm always fingering that in my case. Like, I know the soy absolutely played a role in this. I mean, soy does a lot of wreckage in human bodies, but that's one of the big ones, is that it blocks the absorption of zinc. And without zinc,
I think a lot of people, you know, I think most Americans, for instance, are eating way more soy than they realize. But when you get into veganism, you start eating soy preferentially and on purpose. You know, I think a lot of people don't even know it's there, but a lot of us were eating it, you know, and drinking it constantly.
Yeah. So I had that problem. I also did quite a number on my reproductive organs. So back to the vitamin A, vitamin D thing. If vitamin D is really, really crucial for helping make different hormones in your body. And also the substrate of the mother hormone of all your hormones is cholesterol. And so without that mother substance, you can't make all the other hormones that you need. And your body will preferentially make what it needs to stay alive. And if that means, you know, we'll set aside reproduction for now, we can handle that in a few years. Right now, you just need to stay alive day to day. So a lot of your reproductive function will get kind of shut down, if you don't have enough cholesterol in your diet. And so this is what happens to a lot of vegans. You know, we just don't have enough sex hormones. And so in the case of women, and this is true for women who eat any kind of low fat diet, but it's especially true for vegans. I mean, I just stopped menstruating. I just didn't do it, and nobody knew why. And there was not a single doctor who ever asked me, what do you eat?
In the raw food community, you'll often get this attitude that, oh, menstruation is actually a pathology, and now I'm cured of it by eating this raw food diet, was one of the things I would always hear. On the kind of style of veganism you were in the communities you were in, were you aware at the time that that was pathological, that you had ceased menstruating, and were you looking for solutions to that?
Okay, so I absolutely heard that as well about, it's a good sign if you stop menstruating. But that didn't actually make any sense to me. Like, why would that be a sign of health when this is simply the life cycle of an adult human female? I mean, this is our, you know, our uteruses are designed to do this. And if you're not doing it, there's actually a problem. But it never occurred to me that it was linked to the diet, because when you're in that world, and I have to remember how hard it is, you're surrounded by this ideology that you've embraced, and it becomes such a fundamentalist mindset that it's like there's no way you can acknowledge that the diet might be creating harm. It's not a possible thought to have. And so I just didn't, you know, I was like, well, I don't know what's wrong with me. I guess something. I wasn't intending to have a baby, so it didn't matter all that much, but I sort of knew it wasn't a good sign either that, you know, at age 20, 25, you're supposed to be young and healthy, and that includes being fertile. And it just, I didn't know what to do. So the only thing that the doctors ever said was, well, you can go on birth control pills and that'll kind of stabilize it. But that seemed like a kind of a bizarre. Right. I mean, it seemed very symptomatic. Like, right. Well, why would I do that? Like, there's a deeper thing going on. So I just sort of stopped looking because it was clear. I mean, the doctors just didn't know and nobody was asking me the right questions. This seems so obvious now in retrospect, especially, you know, when you look at just how widespread this is among, you know, women who are athletes and don't have enough body fat, and women, of course, who eat these low fat diets. This is just, it's predictable. And this is not like a mystery. We know why. If you don't have cholesterol, you're not going to get sex hormones. And that's just, you know, the end of the story. So I did that. And then I also ended up with uterine fibroids that I had to have removed. So that wasn't any fun. And the soy also is implicated in all of this. And the reason that I know that that's true. So soy, I'm sure most of your listeners know, but soy, you know, contains this huge load of what are called phytoestrogens. And these are substances that look like estrogen. They're very similar to estrogen, but they're not really the estrogen that mammals produce. So they will lock on to your estrogen receptors. And then whatever actual estrogen your body's producing can't get in to those receptors. So it's worse than having none. It actually is like negative estrogen. And then your body tries to use it and can't really, because it's not exactly, you know, the chemical structure that your body needs. So all of this, a long story short, in my case, it was actually quite dramatic. I also stumbled upon, you know, that Weston Price information. I started reading about soy, completely horrified at like what I had probably done to myself for 20 years. And I decided just to go cold turkey. And I did. I was like, no more soy. That's just out of my diet forever. And I took all the soy out, threw it away, like no more soy ever again. And I am not making this up. After 20 years of basically never menstruating, 2 weeks, I got my period. Wow. Yeah. And I have not missed one since.
And were you still a vegan at that time?
No, it was right on the verge. I had already started eating meat and was feeling dramatically better from that. But I still, you know, my cycle thing was not right. It still was getting, it just had all kinds of hitches in it. And it was so dramatic. I couldn't believe it. I was like, wow, 2 weeks away from the soy. And then every 28 days, it was like clockwork. I was like, this is how your body's supposed to be functioning. And it was just kind of horrible. Like, what did I do to myself? Right. Like when it was that dramatic, you know, so. That, you know, there's another one that I did, and I ended up with an autoimmune disease as well. And you know, that there's a lot of different kind of pathways to autoimmunity problems. And, you know, obviously there's a genetic component. There's no question. There's a streak of it in my family. And so then you have, what turns the genes on? So these are the kinds of things that, yes, exactly. All of that. And for a fact, gluten is part of this little package. And you know, when you're vegan, you're eating all kinds of grains and beans and whatever. And there's a lot of gluten was in my diet. And, for sure that's part of it. You know, one thing we also know is we had this concept of the diseases of civilization. And, you know, those are the diseases people get when they take up agricultural foods. And autoimmune.
Since the beginning of it too. I mean, we'll get into that in a bit, but I mean, this kind of started in the fossil record as soon as they started putting seeds in the ground.
Absolutely. And you know, the first thing you see is rheumatoid arthritis. So you start to see all these autoimmune conditions that had never been seen before. And this is true around the world. And so there's just no question in my mind that this was a part of what triggered that starting up for me was, you know, between the bad genetics and then, you know, the kind of switching to a vegan diet where it was all just, you know, greens and beans and, you know, all those kinds of seeds and stuff. It just did me in. So I have to deal with, I have Hashimoto's. And then the other thing about Hashimoto's, of course, is that there's a soy trajectory to this as well. You'll note that that's a Japanese name. They have a lot of thyroid problems in Japan because there is soy in the diet. And that's what I ended up with, was an autoimmune disease of the thyroid. So between the wheat and the soy, I think it was kind of overdetermined. So those are the main things that I did to myself. There's lots of minor ones, but those were the big ones.
So one thing I wanted to, you know, I've heard you talk about the motivators to this kind of an ideology. And I think you've done a good job of say, of acknowledging that people do this and that you did this. I know I did it for really good reasons, just bad conclusions. And you mentioned about gardening, which kind of to me, from what I'm hearing from you, is like, gives you like a microcosmic view into how ecology works. I certainly look back and see that I had the most quaint, if not actually superstitious ideas about ecology, and a very Garden of Eden motivated kind of thing too, where it's like we all just go back to this utopia by being vegans. So I'd love to hear a little bit about how you saw that now and then what that actually led to, because I think the conclusions you're at now, I know conclusions I'm at and so many others leading us to this idea I call rewilding, and I hear people refer to it in many different ways. Ecological restoration might be another way.
Mm-hmm.
But kind of a lot of us led to a much more realistic, if not less, you know, sometimes less pretty, but much more realistic view of ecology. What was that transition like for you?
That started for me when I was 20. So I'd been a vegan for 4 years. And I was taking a college, in a college class, and the professor was a biologist, and there was this one sentence that he said that absolutely shook me to my core, and he said, "The moment you put a plow to soil, you degrade that soil." And the reason this was so terrifying to me was that I could see, every year there were more people on the planet, which meant every year we were going to have to take over more and more land, dedicate it to human needs, to human food production. But in the process of doing that, if he was correct, we were only digging ourselves a deeper grave. Because if it was inherently destructive, what then? I mean, eventually we were going to run out of planet. And I thought I had found this answer in eating this plant-based vegan diet. But, you know, he stated it as such a fact. And then, of course, he went on to show us all the photographs from around the world that he had taken. There was no arguing with it. It was quite clear that he was telling the truth, and he walked us through it. And I could feel my world just, it was this little earthquake. Like, well, what now? If this is true, what now? And I said that was the demon I wrestled for 20 years. I was the angel I wrestled. What do you do with that? This can't actually be a way forward if in fact it's destructive. And at the end of the day, I gave up being a vegan, and I was in fact able to engage with that information a little bit. You know, I feel like in a much better way, in a much deeper way, but I've come to very different conclusions now about, the place of agriculture, because, at the beginning of my vegan life, I knew nothing about agriculture. I didn't have a clue where my food came from. And this is true for most of us in the industrialized world. We don't know. And so, when I was presented with the vegan arguments as a teenager, as far as it went, it made sense. I mean, factory farming is horrible, and I think everyone can agree to that. But that's as far as it went. Nobody said, oh, and by the way, your corn and your wheat and your soybeans are at least as destructive to the planet.
Factory farmed
too. It's just, they are factory farmed, but you're factory farming plants. And so this is what I had to understand about agriculture, was just the nature of it. Because you take a piece of land, you clear every living thing off it. And I mean down to the bacteria. And then you plant it to human use. So all of those plants and animals and all of those, little microscopic creatures that actually are doing the basic work of life for all of us, they have nowhere to go. So it's biotic cleansing. I mean, we talk about ethnic cleansing. This is biotic cleansing. This is down to the very bottom of life.
And I would add biological enslavement at a level too, because you're taking species from the wild and then domesticating them to your own purposes. So you've done this bio cleansing, and then you bring in your slave species, which you raise in captivity, kind of,
yeah,
genuinely degrading their genes over the course of generations. So you end up with these mutant gluttons and things like that as well.
Yes, I would not argue with that. And so in the process of doing this, this activity called agriculture, we've managed to skin the planet alive. And by 1950, the planet was basically out of topsoil. And the pattern this pattern of this way of life is called civilization, and it's based on this process of agriculture. Before that, and people get confused. They say, oh, but civilization, doesn't that mean art and, you know, all these great things? And okay, there's a difference between culture and civilization, because all human beings live in culture. You know, we're storytelling creatures. Every human lives in some kind of complex story that involves, you know, other humans and the way that you're going to do things and the rules and why you have various rules. And then, you know, the kind of arts and the crafts that we all develop, you know, in our ecosystems and in our human communities and all of that. And that is culture. And we all do that. But civilization is a very specific pattern of culture. And it's actually not that difficult. The word civilization just means people living in cities. Okay. But what that actually means is that those people need more than the land can give. So the food, the water, the energy, they have to come from somewhere else. And from that point forward, it doesn't matter what beautiful, nonviolent values people hold in their hearts or believe in through their religions. That society is now dependent on imperialism and genocide. Because yes. if you have to go out and get your basic resources from somewhere else, no one else is going to give those to you willingly.
Yeah, it's interesting that even if you are a committed vegan in this culture, because you're part of this civilization, you actually live a more violent life than probably multiple persons living in a traditional intact hunter-gatherer society. So it's interesting that this supposed path of nonviolence, just due to the structure of our civilization, isn't one. I want to get into that in a second. I have one last vegan question for you, and I'd like to move away from kind of that part of it, but I'm curious what you experienced for pushback, because I think when you finally get onto this and understand agriculture and the big picture of what civilization's done in the last 10,000 years, it kind of crystallizes in such a way that you see that all of the justice, all of the things that people campaign over and all of the things that we want to see change, I mean, all the problems are born out of civilization, most of them. And that gets really clear, but as you go to tell people, there's like a kill the messenger thing that happens. And I've found in my own experience that many hardcore fundamentalist vegans are some of the most aggressive people that I know. In fact, you know, the attacks that I've received from that side of the house has been like more aggressive than anything I've really ever experienced. And I was one of those people at one point. So I'm just curious, like how what you experienced, because you probably are one of the most, if not in our time, the most vocal person about this topic, and your book was incredibly influential. What was it like after that, and what did you experience?
Well, people either love me or they hate me. I did not intend to be that polarizing. I thought I was writing a very kind of clear-cut, rational book that maybe could persuade people to open their minds a little. But it, of course, did not work out that way. I mean, I know what you're talking about with the extremely angry fundamentalist vegans. And part of that is biochemical. And I have been there. I know what it feels like to be that miserable. You can't keep a stable mood state without enough fat for proper, you know, neurological function, especially your brain, and without the neurotransmitters that, you know, actually make you feel happy and in a good mood. And all of that, it just comes from dietary fat and dietary protein, and you're not getting the right kinds, and you're definitely not getting enough when you're a vegan. And this is why, the studies show that people who are vegan are 2 to 3 times as likely to have some kind of mental illness. And I'm not saying that to be like snide or sarcastic. And this is what happens when you deny the human brain its proper fuel. This is again, predictable. And I know what it feels like to feel that bad all the time. I mean, if I couldn't find my wallet, I would sit on the floor and cry. Like there was no bounce, you know, it was terrible. And I was not the kind of person who went, to the anger side of it. To me, it was more like the depression, you know, fall down the well kind of, you know, but I certainly know the angry kind, and it's easy to go there when you're feeling that unstable all the time. So I have a lot of compassion for these people. I know how bad it feels on a moment to moment basis. When you're starving your brain. But it's hard because of course I get a lot of hate mail. I've had my
still
life threat.
Still to this
I've
day.
Had, oh yeah, absolutely. Wow. I mean, I have a house alarm. I have a permit to carry, and I have 2 gigantic dogs. And this
what
is what
state,
it's been.
What state are you in?
I'm in California.
You had a permit to carry in California. Wow.
Yes, I do. Yeah.
Congratulations.
So yeah, but this is what it's driven me to. Yeah, and I, you know, we can joke, but it's, these people are very serious and they've threatened to throw acid in my face and you got to take that seriously. So I don't speak without security now. And it's just, it's not what I expected, but you know, I'm not going to shut up. I mean, my planet is at risk and I want people to understand this information. I don't care what anybody eats. I don't care. Like do whatever you want, but I want the people who care most about the severe crisis we are facing to understand the nature of the problem. And most vegans don't. And
yeah, that's, it's interesting because your work is, there's a couple components to it because there's this issue of what's happening in the big picture ecologically on the planet and from a justice perspective. But then there's also a lot of individuals that a lot of the individuals that you would seek to help are actually the ones who are, I guess, perpetrating that aggression. That's got to be challenging because there's the two things. I want to go into the ecological perspective a little bit and talk about that. And I also want to make sure we talk about, because I know you've written on, radical feminism, and I'm endlessly fascinated by the egalitarianism that we see when we look at hunter-gatherer people, at least in general. I know we're painting with a big broad brush, but I think that there's this, today there's this idea of feminism, and the challenge that I have, or I see with it, is that in the current structure of our civilization, it's almost like a problem that can't, we live in a hierarchical dominant civilization, right? So it's hard to create equality in a situation that is fundamentally hierarchical. So can you kind of explain the relationship of hierarchy and patriarchy to agriculture and sort of how all that works together?
Right. So here's the deal with agriculture is, you know, it's this inherently dominating activity where you're fighting a war with the natural world. The world, the living planet does not actually want to be a monocrop. And that's what you're doing when you do agriculture. Because like I said, you've cleared all the life off that land. And that's hundreds, even thousands of species. And when you get down to the microorganisms, you're talking about a million living creatures per tablespoon of soil. And that's what you're killing, in order to grow this monocrop just for humans. And if you look across, you know, huge swaths of the earth at this point, like, you know, the Great Plains in the United States or, you know, various kinds, what used to be grasslands all around the world, that's what you see is this massive destruction. So, I mean, we call them the flyover states, but if you've ever driven through Nebraska or Iowa, you know what I'm talking about. It's just mile after mile after mile of corn or wheat or soy. And there should be, per square meter, there should be 25 different plants per square meter in a functioning prairie, and it's all been turned into one. And then you have all the different layers of life that, you know, kind of live in that cycle together on, in those grasslands, and all of that is gone. So, you know, there were 60 million bison on this continent when the European invasion started. There were so many bison. I mean, the descriptions of what people saw, you could sit in place for 4 days and watch one herd thunder by. That's one herd. Like, it's just uncountable
and
numbers of bison.
And in fairness, that's just the bison. I mean,
that's
the
just the bison.
Horn, the elk,
oh, I know.
I mean, so many species.
Just
that
on the wolves and the the prairie dogs and the black-footed ferrets and the prairie chickens and everybody.
Right.
You know, just the amount of life. And you can go to any ecosystem and hear these historical descriptions of what it was like. I mean, where I am here in the Pacific Northwest, it was the salmon runs. Were that kind of dense life. And there are still people alive who can talk about 24 hours before you actually saw fish, you would hear them coming up the river. You said it was like rolling thunder in the background, and it got louder and louder and louder, and then finally you saw the fish. And that's all gone, you know?
Yes,
so this
and
is
on
what
the East Coast,
destroyed.
We deal with the same thing. I mean, our Atlantic salmon populations, you know, our rivers are dammed, and of course now they're federally protected, and we have landlocked salmon, but we don't have our salmon runs. And so this is true around the world, and it's interesting with the so-called discovery of North America, because agriculture had played out in Europe and for so long that it was like, oh, we found a new place we can do that to. You know, like really exciting. This one's still full. But in fairness, there was agriculture going on in North America. I'm curious kind of how you see that, because we have certainly, if we go to Mesoamerica with the Aztec civilization, or we go south of that to, let's say, the Inca civilization, they were maize growing. I mean, they were doing the same thing, degrading their topsoil, mm-hmm. creating collapsing civilizations. But as you came north, you had this hunter-gatherer slash horticultural thing going on. I'm curious how you see that, and then I want to go, you know, continue the explanation of sort of how all of these things fit together. But just curious, like, what you think about that mixed approach that they had?
So a lot of the corn cultures in North America were also on their way to collapse. So you have like Cahokia in Ohio, the mound building cultures, they had already collapsed. So there were all the, and there were little like city states across the southeast that were corn cultures, and they were absolutely at war with each other, just like they had done in ancient Greece and ancient Italy. It's the exact same pattern, where they were more and more and more militarized, and their, you know, their health was degrading, you know, every year they were more disease ridden, they were shorter, their bones were brittle, all of that was going on. And, there's, you know, historical descriptions from the first Spaniards that kind of walked across that area of, you know, how every, whatever, 10 miles or 20 miles, you'd find another sort of small city that was surrounded by, these armaments, you know, like there'd be this kind of giant fence. And at the top, there'd be the bow and archers, you know, the archer guys with the arrows, and they'd, you know, just be sitting there on patrol all the time waiting for the next attack. So it was absolutely agriculture follows the same pattern no matter where you go. It was the exact same
thing. And it's so important that we say that, because there's this tendency, especially because we've gotten so new agey here in the West, there's this tendency to be like, oh yeah, we got it wrong, but the Inca had it right, the Maya had it right, the Aztec had it right, or every, you know, always some exotic civilization. But it's really the same everywhere, right? And it's also interesting to note that they always get off on some grass. So it's like maize over here, it's rice yeah. over in Asia, it's wheat and barley over in Mesopotamia, but it's always over this grass, right? So okay, so these civilizations crop up, they become militarized. Like, just describe that sort of pattern that it follows.
Okay, so you have a way of life that's based on drawdown. Okay, so drawdown, you know, if you use more wood than a forest can grow, the forest will be gone. And if you take fish faster than they can reproduce, one day that river will be nothing but water and sorrow. And it's the same with the soil. You just keep using it. And with agriculture, that's the problem. First of all, you've cleared all the life off it. And now every year you have to keep clearing it to plant those seeds and to get that monocrop. And in the process of doing that, not only have you killed off all these other creatures, but you're killing the soil itself, because just like us, when it's exposed, it dies. So the sun bakes it and the rain pounds it. And then, you know, the wind just blows it away and it turns into dust. And that's what's happened around the world. But in the process of doing this, of course, your population has temporarily exploded, because all of that land went just to feed humans.
Way bigger food surpluses than you could ever get from foraging.
Well, exactly. And so this makes a bunch of problems. One is, if you have a surplus, it has to be stored, right? And if it can be stored, that means it can be stolen. And now you've got to have somebody who can guard it. And those people are called soldiers. Okay. Another problem is, you know, this whole concept of the drawdown and the collapse. To fend that off, you're going to have to go out and conquer your neighbors and use up their soil and their water and their trees and their fish. Nobody's going to hand use that stuff willingly, because they need it. So you have to have a military to go out and grab it. And that's the pattern of civilization. You have this power center at the middle, and then it's surrounded by these conquered colonies. And then the center extracts what it wants. And then eventually the whole thing collapses. And that collapse takes between 800 and 2,000 years. And that's the amount of time it takes for the soil to give out. Literally 800 to 2,000 years. That's it. There's no civilization that's lasted longer than that. There have been 34, and they've all collapsed.
I just want to add something to that before we go on, because I feel like there's this like mythology in our civilization that we are going through technology to last forever. And people don't like it when you point it out, but as you just said, like, the track record is no civilization makes it longer than 2,000 years, if that. And here we are sort of kind of creeping up toward our collapse time and showing all this, the signs, the fractures and the signs of collapse. But I think it's important that people really hear that thing you just said, that like, there isn't any track record of a civilization that's remained intact and been able to do that, is there?
No, and if you think about it, there can't be, because it's based on drawdown. Right. So the moment that you're using more than can naturally be regenerated, you've got a downward sloping line, and it will eventually hit zero. Whether it's 800 years or 2,000 years, you do eventually use it all up. So that's the problem. This is a way of life that, you know, the end was written into the beginning. There's no way forward except into collapse. And I don't say that with any glee. It's just physical reality.
I have a little glee just because of how disproportionate the injustices are of it, whether it's no matter where we look. And so I'm just going to be honest. I get a little glee because it's been so, and as somebody who hunts and gathers, it's like this, there's a connection to ecology that I have today that I understand how much people are suffering out there, even if they don't know it, from a lack of relationship to the natural world. And I want to talk a little bit too about the role of husbandry, because it's interesting when you look at this word husband, it means to, of course, to take a wife, and it means to domesticate animals, and it means to domesticate plants, and it means to run a household. And of course, domestication means of the household. So it's like, along with this whole suite of things came this transition from an egalitarian way where the society of women and the society of men functioned together in equal but different ways to this radically different kind of patriarchy. Yeah. So I'm curious how you see that and its relationship to agriculture as well.
Right. So, another reason we talked about, you know, how you need soldiers to store the surplus and to go out and, you know, conquer your neighbors. So another problem, another one of the ways that civilization destroys human relationships is that it's also dependent on slavery. It's agriculture's backbreaking labor. And the only reason that we've forgotten this is because we've been using fossil fuel now to do that work. But at the beginning of the fossil fuel age, so year 1800, right around there, 3/4 of the human beings alive on this planet, 3/4 of the people on the planet were living in some form of serfdom, indenture, or slavery. 3/4.
Wow.
Okay. So that's what agriculture creates.
Without fossil fuel, it would revert to that in a moment.
So that's what it is. It's backbreaking labor from dawn to dusk, and the only people who have leisure are the people at the very top of the pyramid.
That's why we had slavery here in North America, largely, was for farming, right?
I mean, absolutely. It's a wretched activity. I mean, it just, you know, and it wears you out. And so this is the beginning of slavery, is this agricultural way of life. It's civilization. It doesn't exist before that. Hunter-gatherers have no need for slaves. They don't work that much. They enjoy what they do. And it wouldn't make you, how would you even keep people captive? It doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. You know, as you're roaming around, there's not even really a good way to do it.
And what would you, this is something I find
What would you have them do?
I geek out on this, place, Göbekli Tepe, you know, are you familiar with what I'm talking about? This site in Turkey. It's like the oldest monolithic site, but it was built by hunter-gatherers, and it's built 20 miles from where the first wheat was domesticated.
Oh, I know what you're talking
right?
about.
So
yeah,
I've been thinking about this for years, trying to understand it, because now they're saying, okay, it would have taken 500 able-bodied workers around the clock for a decade to build this thing. And in the beginning of it, they were hunter-gatherers, but by the end, they're like eating wheat. And you just kind of realize if you're going to have slaves, you have to feed them.
If
you're hunter-gatherers, you can't be gathering double, triple what you need. It's hard to do that. I mean, that's a lot of hunting and gathering. But wheat becomes this easy way to, like, feed bread, you know, the food of slaves, right? It's funny, but you got to feed them, too. It's not realistic as hunter-gatherers to have a whole bunch of slaves around.
Well, now you're on this downward spiral as a culture, because now you need soldiers to go out and conquer the neighbors. You need soldiers to keep the slave population in check. Because if 90% of the population is enslaved, someone's got to keep them there. So there's not constant uprisings, right? And you now already have a culture where you understand that that conquering is possible. I mean, that there's this concept of the dominator mode. And now this is just fully fledged. And so, of course, this is going to affect the way that, you know, there's relationships between men and women. So if you need breeding stock for soldiers, you're going to keep women as chattel property. And if you need to hate your neighbors so that you can vilify them, you know, this is essentially racism of one form or another. And the only way you're going to keep your stock pure is to make sure you control the reproductive capacities of women so that you know who the father was and that it wasn't the, you know, horrible subhuman person to the south, that it was, you know, one of the pure good people of your culture. And so all of this is what, you know, eventually ends up, no matter how nice these cultures start as goddess worshiping, egalitarian, whatever, you can't go into this and end with that same culture. You're going to end up with these levels of hierarchy, and that's going to include men over women. So, and that's, you know, across the board as well. They get, as time goes on, each of these civilizations gets more and more patriarchal. And so that's where we are now. So, yeah.
I know it's like, oh, okay. So let's talk about a way forward. And, you know, here in podcast land, or at least the side where I'm, the part of podcast land I'm in, is like always this desire to like spin everything in the most positive way. Okay. Cause we're in that time in history where everybody just wants to be fluffed all the time. And looking at the path forward, I'm just kind of, I want to hear, cause some of the things, I know you've done some work with Derek Jensen and, and that talked about sort of some more radical solutions. And I want to just talk about all that because like, what are people to do? And I'll share just briefly that where I've ended up after kind of my journey with all of this is I hunt, I gather, and I work with local farmers whenever I can. And then I have my dirty, you know, secret trips to Whole Foods for the things I can't get anymore. And, but as I go on, I'm able to hunt more, gather more. I've got, you know, I'm protein self-sufficient. I'm getting quite carbohydrate self-sufficient at this point, but there's, you know, there's chinks in all that. And one of the major ones is I get constantly people writing me going, well, 7 billion people can't do that. And I,
well, they can't.
Right.
They can't.
And I, and in a way I'm privileged to get to do what biologically I'm built to do, which is strange. So let's talk about the path forward because one of the things that we're always hearing about organic farms and organic food, but when I think back to past civilizations, it was organic farming that caused them to collapse. I mean, it wasn't like they were doing, you know, chemical agriculture.
Right.
You mentioned before that, you know, not only did fossil fuels help to kickstart this modern agriculture system, but it's also how we fertilize the soil and why we've been able to extract just a bit more, a couple more, you know, generations out of the soil. So is organic farming like a realistic path back to restoration? And if not, like what are solutions that you've come up with?
Well, I don't, you know, want to be mean to the organic farmers. I'm glad they're at least trying, but, I don't see this as a way forward. I think that the human race has to face what we did when we took up agriculture. And I think we have to give it up. It is the most destructive human activity. It's the most destructive thing people have done to the planet. And it's the beginning of global warming, in fact. Yeah. Because when you burn through all that soil, what that means is it's literally just releasing carbon. It was stored. It was part of the structure of soil. And when you introduce all that oxygen and it just burns up the organic matter, what you're literally doing is releasing carbon. And we, for a fact, you know, what we know absolutely, the rice agriculture was the one that really kicked off global warming.
Oh, wow.
There's a really great book called Plows, Plagues, and Petroleum. And it's, I highly recommend that, but he really goes into this. That is absolutely the beginning. In fact, if you took, from the very beginning of agriculture to the year 1800 and then the year 1800 to the present, the same amount of carbon was released into the atmosphere from the beginning of agriculture to 1800. Now it took longer than when we started burning fossil fuel, but that amount of carbon had already been released.
Right. Wow.
Just from doing agriculture, from destroying all that soil.
So all this fossil fuel allowed
give it up.
Us to accelerate it rapidly.
It's accelerated. You've exactly got that.
But
and
it was happening anyway.
It was happening and it's going to end the same way, whether we've been able to extend it for another few generations by learning how to use fossil fuel as fertilizer. But all that meant was the human population quadrupled.
And what about all this like greenwashing? My listeners are going to be like, yeah, here he goes again. But I get so annoyed with, and I'm not saying it's bad. It's like, I'm glad that the Prius exists, but it's so easy to be like, I bought a Prius. I'm helping with the environment. It's like, no, you're still hurting the environment. You're just hurting it a little less than the guy with that car.
But I'm not even convinced they're hurting it less. I mean, the amount of energy that goes into producing those high tech components.
Right.
It's insane.
So there's this belief that we're all these things that we're doing. Oh, we recycle and we drive Priuses and I bring my bags to the store and all of that. And people feel absolved of the ills wrought by the life way of our civilization. So knowing that, like, how do you see that greenwashing and like, what's your synopsis of all of it?
Yeah. So my synopsis is that I think a lot of people are in terrible despair because they have at least faced somewhat. You know, the crisis that we're in, that we really might end life on this planet in the next century. And in fact, it may be sooner. I mean, Guy McPherson thinks it's 10 years, basically. I don't know. I don't make predictions. I don't think that, you know, the system is so large, who knows when it's actually all going to just be done. But we could easily be looking at a planet that's almost as warm as Venus. So it's the end of life. I mean, we are facing that, you know, within somebody's lifetime, that's going to happen. So I think to some degree people know that. If you're in any way, you know, paying attention to what's going on, you know that it's bad out there. And I think that the environmental movement has been completely hijacked by all this. And it used to be a movement about protecting the places and the creatures that we loved. And as a whole, that meant planet Earth. And instead it's become, how do we continue to fuel the destruction of those places and those creatures? And I don't understand how that happened. I mean, I have ideas about how that happened, but it still doesn't make any sense to me. Because now it's, how are we going to find the fuel to do this? Well, all right, fossil fuel's a problem, so we'll just use wind and solar and biomass and whatever else. But we can keep still living this way. Oh, thank God, that was what we wanted. And it's like, that's actually not what I wanted. Because this way of life is literally about converting the living to the dead. And I don't want to be part of that. That was the whole point, was that we were trying to save those places and those creatures and not continue to eat them, you know, just literally devour them for what? You know, it's 10 minutes of fun. It just doesn't make any sense. So anyway, I think that a lot of people do feel that despair. And so, you know, they've been handed a set of simple solutions that's like blinders, essentially. It's, you know, if I do these 10 things, then it'll get better. And they're fairly useless personal lifestyle.
Switch your light bulbs.
Yeah. And it's just, this is no way faces the scale of the problem. And so we do need solutions that are commensurate with the scale of the problem. Those are not actually, you know, intellectually difficult. You know, the problem is that they are certainly emotionally difficult for many people. But this is kind of a no-brainer. I mean, it's like, what are the activities that are killing the planet? Great. Well, we just have to stop them. We have to stop industrial agriculture and then agriculture generally and then, you know, industrial logging, industrial fishing, like all the things that are actually wiping out ecosystems. We just stop doing them, which really shouldn't be that hard, honestly. I mean, these are things people are doing. People can simply stop. My best solution, the one that I really think is, you know, the linchpin in all of this, is that we've got to repair what we've destroyed, especially the grasslands. And some of the numbers on this are really very hopeful, that if we were to take even 75% of the planet's trashed out grasslands and restore them to the prairies that they would like to be, with their cohort of animals, and that especially includes ruminants, which we can talk about, but the grasses and the ruminants, it's not too late. It would only take about 15 years and we really could sequester all of the carbon that's been released since the beginning of the fossil fuel age.
Now, the problem is this area that was prairie is the prime growing locale, if I understand it right, is prime growing location for domesticated grain, which are grasses, too.
Because it's grasses, exactly. This is who wants to live in the grasslands. You've either got the perennial grasses that actually belong there, or you have the imported domesticated annual grasses that, you know, humans have messed with. So, yes, it's the exact same. So we need to be reducing our numbers, you know, reducing our impact at the same time that we repair what we've destroyed, and let those grasses come home. We could help that process, but even if we just stopped destroying, they would come back. It doesn't actually take that long, because grasses are very mighty creatures, and, you know, the Earth wants her grasslands back, and every other living creature on this planet will make it happen. It's their home. You know, they will come back if we just let them do it. But certainly there are ways to help it happen faster.
So how do we do that from a food systems perspective? So you've got all these people relying on the food grown in these now, you know, beat up prairies. So for us to start the rewilding of the prairie land, and I know there are projects underway, but they're extremely limited in scale, right? So there is some idea to restore bison over some of the habitat and restore prairie and here in the United States. But I mean, we're not talking about, you know, multi-state projects. We're talking about these tiny little parks, right?
Yeah, though there are people who dream big about that, about the Buffalo Commons. And that, honestly, it's the more that your listeners can read up on that and learn about that, it really is one of the only hopes our planet has. So there's a project called the Buffalo Commons. There was a book that was written about it. And then there are people who really want to create just this massive, you know, restored prairie in the middle of the continent. And it's, I mean, they're hated, but it's a really interesting idea. And it really, I think it's one of the only hopes we have. And then you have people like Alan Savory who are, you know, on the ground figuring out how to turn desert back into savanna and prairie. And, you know, there's a few million acres now that are essentially under his care, under his students' care. And there's
that many, huh?
Fantastic results.
Wow.
Anybody just go look at his TED Talk.
Sure.
Just go to TED Talk and type in Alan Savory, him and some of his students. They've got some great TED Talks and you can look at the pictures. You cannot help but be convinced.
Especially now because this idea, there's that film, no doubt you're familiar with, Cowspiracy, having gone around the circuit.
Oh God, right.
I know, and it really, it's unfortunate, but it led people to, it's just so nice to have one scapegoat. It's like, it's the cows. And it's like, no, it's the method of rearing these cows. It's definitely a problem, but, you know, this continent hosted 30 to 60 million bison. That's a lot of cows, essentially, you know, very similar kind of ruminants. So, you know, can you explain that a little bit too? Cause I think people are very confused. I think it's just like with the meat versus vegan kind of argument right now. People find it very confusing. And I think people feel really confused about this idea of ruminants. Are they good? Are they bad? Where do they fit? Et cetera.
Right. So let's remember the scale of this, like how many ruminants there should be on this continent and also across the other, you know, huge grasslands around the world and how reduced those herds are. Okay. That they've been pretty well wiped out from their native habitats. And they were there for a bunch of millions of years and they did not trash the planet. Okay. So just using your common sense, there's no way that ruminants are the problem. We know what the problem is. It's people using fossil fuel. And it's ridiculous to blame ruminants for what is a completely human-created problem. But to get more specific, all right, let's take 1 acre of land. Now you can do, we're going to have plan A and plan B. On plan A, you take that land, you clear everything off it, all right? So you rip up the grasses, you take out the trees, you know, just destroy it all the way down. You drive off all the animals, everybody, birds, ruminants, everybody, like reptiles, nobody's allowed. Just you and your corn, and you grow an acre of corn. So, and then you have to apply a whole bunch of fossil fuel because there's no other way to get the nitrogen into those plants. So you've applied a whole bunch of toxic chemicals and, the nearby, you're draining out the water table while you do this because of course none of the annual plants have the kind of extensive root systems that perennials have. They don't have time to grow roots like that and they don't bother. So if you look at like a prairie root system or a forest root system, you're going to see roots that go down, just down, 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 20 feet, 30 feet, all the way down to bedrock. And those roots do beautiful things. They break up the actual rock underneath there, the substrate, and then they pull it up and the rest of the living community at the surface of the earth can now use those minerals. That's where we get our minerals by and large, is from the action of those perennial roots. But annual systems, of course, don't have perennial plants. They don't, agriculture doesn't use perennials. So you're mining the soil. That's what they call it. You mine the soil because every time you plant those annual crops, you're just sucking the minerals out and not replacing them. There's no way to replace them. So you're destroying the surface, the substance of the soil, the actual structure of it. You're taking all the minerals out. You're not replacing them. And then the water, as it rains, has no way to enter the soil. The roots of those perennial plants actually make physical channels that, so that water can actually physically enter the soil and recharge the water table and recharge the local streams and ponds and whatever waterways are nearby. Without those perennial roots, it doesn't happen. And the water just washes off and makes huge floods and destroys the soil even more. And now all of that silt is running toward what, you know, what the nearest riverways are. And it, you know, ends up in the river. And now the water is too murky and the fish can't live in it. So you're killing off all the fish now in the local river as well. So you've just got death and destruction all around. Okay. But you've got this acre of corn. Okay. For a little bit, you can do this with the fossil fuel. This is not going to last forever, but for a few generations, maybe you can do this. So you've got this acre of corn. What do you do with it? Well, you harvest it and now you take it to a really unpleasant cement city in which cows are being forced to live, you know, in a steel structure on a cement floor, and you feed those cows a completely unhealthy, unnatural diet of that corn. And that 1 acre of corn will essentially feed one cow in a really miserable way, and that cow will be incredibly sick and end up with, you know, holes in her stomach and a toxic liver and all the rest of it. And then at the end of her sad life, you're going to kill her, feed her to people. The amino acid profile is wrong. The fatty acid profile is wrong. You're going to end up with a whole bunch of sick humans on top of it. And at the end of the day, this entire thing will collapse because you're just on drawdown. So that's it. You've killed everything. Okay. And everybody's miserable. All right. That's plan A. That's what we're doing right now. Plan B, you leave that grassland intact. You don't do anything to it. You just leave it there. Don't do anything bad to it. You just leave it. And on that same acre of grass, you can raise, guess what? One cow. It's the same cow. Only now, because of the action of her eating the grasses, She's stimulating more roots to grow. That's what happens when you eat grasses. They are actually evolved with ruminants to do that. So they've got better root structure. And as she walks along eating, she's also fertilizing and she's watering. It keeps the water cycle completely intact. All the nutrients are there that the grasses need. And because this acre of grass is intact, that means that there's habitat for all sorts of other creatures. So you've got birds, ground dwelling birds, you've got little amphibians, you've got, little mammals. Everybody can live there. Birds can migrate through. You've got a home. You've got actual habitat for the creatures that need a home. And you're recharging the water table constantly. Every time it rains, the water can go somewhere. The local rivers are looking good. They're happy. They're healthy. There's fish in them. That system could go on forever until the sun burns out. Everything that's needed is there. Those are all creatures that evolved together for millions of years, and they know what they're doing. And our role as apex predators is to keep the ruminants in check a little bit. Because like anybody, they're going to, we all evolve with predators. And so, they need bears and they need wolves and they need humans to keep them moving. Okay. And this is one of the things about what they call mob grazing or, managed grazing is, if you just have cows standing around or bison or whoever, and there's no force moving them, they won't move and they can in fact degrade it. And that's of course the model that is used now with cows across the West is nobody's pushing them along. Yes, but the moment. Because they're sedentary. Yes, exactly. But the moment that you add the predators back in, it's like the lifeblood. It's literally a heartbeat that pushes the grazing animals, from one spot to another. And, it's that, intensive grazing, and then quickly moving them off that, makes prairies be that kind of sustainable pattern. That's what grasses need, and that's also what the ruminants need. So it keeps everybody healthier. And then you have this lush grassland that follows in the path of that. And so it's all about the numbers of the ruminants and then the amount of time that they spend on that grass. And by taking the predators out and by not behaving like proper predators ourselves, yes, grazing animals can absolutely degrade land right into desert. But it's not the grazing animal's fault. And you cannot have a healthy grassland without ruminants. They're symbiotic with the grasses.
Do you think that we'll need to, because, I talked to my friend Ben Falk, a permaculturist in Vermont, and he said, I've asked him about the abandonment of agriculture versus, permaculture. And he says, well, you don't break somebody's arm and then just abandon it to let it heal by itself. You set it. And, I've heard you talk a bit about Joel Salatin and his polyculture kind of farming method too. Do you think that if we had the dream end state of the abandonment of agriculture, do you think we need a transition zone of restorative agricultural practices? Because like I said, for me, I don't feel like I have a lot of skin in that game. I'm going down the hunter-gatherer path as far as I can. And yet, I know that that's not going to feed everybody, and I would hate to see everybody, again, stripping the land bare of wild resources too. So do you see that as a necessary in-between phase as we watch the sort of collapse of our current food system and transition to a new one?
For me, I think the best thing we can do is just get to work right now restoring those grasslands and putting the ruminants right back on. You actually could get the same amount of calories out of that land.
Yeah. Cows from Asia and Eurasia, right? The Bos Taurus. And here we've got bison, we've got elk, we've got moose, we've got deer. So ideally we see the restoration of our indigenous animals here in North America, right? I feel like the cow has this place in Eurasia, but so ultimately would you see that being the animals that are endemic to place, I guess?
I think that for most of North America, the bison are going to be supreme. They're going to last in a way that cows don't. They have much better instincts to survive, especially the Great Plains. When the wind is blowing, cows actually, they go in the wrong direction. They will go with the wind because it's the path of least resistance and it hurts them the least. When the wind is blowing really hard, the bison actually do the exact opposite. They will turn and walk into the wind. And what that means is they get out of it sooner.
Yeah.
And so they know how to survive and that for obvious reasons, they have survived. The interesting thing about bison though is that they came across the Bering Strait about 10,000 years ago. They have not been here all that long.
Yeah.
They've managed to figure out how to survive here in ways that, just increase biodiversity.
When the other megafauna, in fairness too, I believe there were three species of bison here prior to that sort of big die-off that happened 10,000 years ago. So they are sort of recent survivors here and one of the only species to figure out when all the megafauna died off. I mean, I think it is important too. Yeah. Like you're mentioning, I mean, the world is a place in flux and always in change. So what's the future of your work and what are you working on now and what is it you're doing?
So I'm writing a book with two of my friends and it's called Bright Green Lies. And it goes back to that, we touched on about the, you know, how this constant push for this sort of technological fundamentalism and this belief that somehow technology is going to save us, is really just, smoke and mirrors. And, you know, it's the same industrial platform. It's the same amount of industrial energy. It's all just either fossil fuel or alternative fossil fuel ultimately. And we're trying to explain to people that wind and solar and these other, and, you know, hydro especially, that none of these can possibly fuel, first of all, the way of life that we have. And second of all, you know, the underlying question, why would you want to continue this? Because it's just nothing but devouring the planet alive. And I don't see that why we would want to continue to fuel that is, you know, like, so the larger framework that nobody's questioning it anymore. I mean, you go back to the beginning of the environmental movement and that absolutely was on everybody's minds, but it's just completely gone now. And it's all just, how are we going to continue this way of life?
It's like the hippies became the yuppies kind of a thing. Environmental movement.
Really kind of scary thing. And again, I think these are people who care very deeply and they seem to understand that we are fast approaching this crisis, but, they're going to have to give it up. It's just the only sustainable way of life is a sustainable way of life. I mean, it's just, that doesn't matter what we want in the here and now. Like this reality does not bend to my wishes. You know, much as we might all wish that we were 2 years old and we could keep believing that, it's not true. And we really need to take up our adult responsibilities and face this in a way that's about being a grown up.
Leah, what fuels you to continue to, say what you just said? Because so many people do over time, they get soft on these things and they get cushy and then it the message softens. And before you know it, they're living that greened up version of the exact same lifestyle. Like, what is it that's driving you so strong and how do you keep that energy going? Especially in light of, you laid out some health problems earlier that for a lot of people would give them the excuse to get out of the game a little bit. So what's keeping you moving and how do you maintain that?
Well, at the risk of sounding self-aggrandizing, truth and love. And the truth is I'm not somebody who can back down from truth easily. It's no matter how hard it is, I want to tell the truth, and it doesn't really matter if I'm emotionally uncomfortable with it or not. This is just the facts of what is happening on this planet. And I would like to be one of the people who tried to sound the alarm, even if, you know, it all ends in just utter disaster for all of life. At least somebody tried. So I would like to be one of the people who at least tried. And that brings me to love, which is that I love this planet and I love the creatures on it and they are my kin. You know, I don't understand not feeling that when you look at a tree or a wolf or a robin, or I'm just looking out my window right now and seeing who's out there. There's rhododendrons about to bloom and they're, you know, like it's just, all of it is so extraordinary. And the more you learn about every creature, like the more in awe you have to be of their particular magic and their particular power and their intelligence, like the amount of just how they all communicate and how they all work together and how the whole thing just makes more life. And how can that not be your religion? Like this is what matters. And right. So that's the love part. Like I'm motivated because I just love all of it and I don't want it to die and I don't want it to die on my watch. So if there's still a chance left that we can fight for it, then we have a responsibility to do that. So even if it's only the slimmest little chance at this point, then it may be, but I'm not the person who's going to give up.
This is my last kind of serious question for you. And that's, what's your prognosis for the future? When you're looking in your magic eight ball, do you feel pessimistic or optimistic? And do you think human beings will be extinct in the near to long future? Or do you think that we can find a way to live harmoniously on this earth with the other species that live here too?
So we lived on this planet for 2.5 million years without being monsters and destroyers. We know how to participate. That's quite clear in our history. This last 10,000 years is really the aberration. So there's every chance that we could remember again how to be humble participants. The question is, are we going to? And I don't see a single institution, the institutions that control us right now, I don't see a single one headed in the right direction. So I am very pessimistic, and I also, I'm just stubborn. So I'm, you know, I've dug in my heels, and this is my battle, and I'm not giving up. So, and I don't know whether there will be enough of us to turn this ship around. I don't think that there will be. So I, like I said, I'm very pessimistic about it, but I do wake up every morning happy, and I'm glad to be alive, and I'm glad to keep fighting.
Thank you for being honest about that. I appreciate that a lot. And I echo that, especially some days. I really feel that same exact thing. Where do you send people for your work? And, you know, how do you like people to get a hold of your books?
Best thing is my website, and that's really easy. And I say that because it's kind of a joke. You have to know how to spell my name. So it's L-I-E-R-R-E. It's Lierre Keith. If you can't remember that, the simplest thing, honestly, is just go to your favorite, whatever, Google, and type in vegetarian myth, because there's only one person who wrote a book with that title, and it's me. So if you can't remember my name, you can definitely remember vegetarian myth, and that will take you to me. It will also take you to a lot of very ugly things about me, but hopefully you'll skip those over and just go right to the book. My website has everything for sale that you might want, and there's plenty of YouTube videos if you just want to listen to a podcast or something. And yeah, my speaking schedule is way behind on my website, but eventually it will be updated. So if you want to see me in person, that's the best way to find out.
I find that that's a similar kind of thing that goes on with most people who are doing really good work in the world, is like, we're not super excited to be working on our websites all the time. All right. Well, Lierre, thank you so much for taking the time today. I just want you to know, for me personally, your work really, like I said, it really helped me in a time I really needed it. And so I'm just one more person saying that to you. And I just, it means a lot to me that you have held out and not let the pressure against you soften your message. It means the world to me. We're always here to support you. Love to know when your book's coming out, and love to have you back on then. Just thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you too.
You've been listening to the Rewild Yourself podcast. Like what you've heard? Head over to iTunes now to subscribe to the show and leave us a rating and review. Want to talk more about this episode, suggest a guest, or offer feedback? Then join the conversation on the Daniel Vitalis Facebook page. And as always, the resources and links from this episode are available at danielvitalis.com, where you can sign up for my newsletter, which comes out twice a month on the full and new moon. Thanks for listening, and keep rewilding.